Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price. You want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Price match applies to same item. Current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowest price guarantee.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice after a one-week vacation. For me, I'm recording this right before I leave on vacation. And I've got good news and bad news. The bad news is I had promised you guys that you were going to hear from Amanda Knox today, and that was the plan. Bad news for me is as I'm recording this, about 30 minutes before we were supposed to record that interview, I got word from Amanda that she was not going to be able to make it. She wanted to reschedule in a couple of days out, but as I told you guys, I was leaving for vacation, like literally right after this. This was the last thing I was going to do before I went. So I needed to come up with something. The good news is I'm not leaving you with nothing for this week. I had to think of something like really quick, like I had an hour. And this is what I came up with, and I think it's going to be great for you guys. So what I'm going to do is, the good news part is, you're going to get two episodes today. One of them's dropping at 6 o'clock in the morning if you're one of those bright listeners that listens first thing. And the other one's going to drop about noon today. And those two episodes are actually two of the episodes from the Underestimated podcast. So you guys know, this is the podcast that my students put together. They've been working on for an entire year. They just finished them up. There are about 16 episodes that aired before these two, and then there's still, I think, 5 or 6 or 7 more to come after this on the Underestimated feed. So I thought these two episodes are a great combination to give you guys as a preview if you haven't gone over and checked out Underestimated yet. What these are, they're episodes 4 and 5 from the Jeanette Robertson series. The way the Underestimated podcast works is each of the 5 groups took on a case. They first each put out 3 episodes about their case. So every 3 episodes, it jumps from one case to another one. And then they came back and put out 2 to 3 more episodes as their final exam. And that's what these are. Now, the Jeanette Robertson case is 1 of the 5. But these two episodes together, again, they're a great preview. And the reason is because if you haven't already listened to the first 3, there's a ton of great details and interviews that happen in those first 3 episodes. But even if you haven't listened to those yet, these two episodes will still make sense for you. And the reason is because the first one is where they've developed the profile for the Jeanette Robertson case. And they actually read to you the profile that they wrote for Jim Clemente. And in that profile, it goes through the basic case facts. So you'll be able to hear the basic case facts and their profile. And then the next episode, you're going to hear a familiar voice. Jim Clemente came back in and reviewed the profile that the students put together, gave them any minor tweaks, and then the episode ends with them applying that profile to known suspects. These are two really powerful episodes. I think it's incredible. I'm super proud of all my kids. And I'm really proud of this group because I think what they put together is what you might expect from any professional. And I want to remind you guys when you're listening to this, as they knock your socks off, that these are teenagers that have never done anything like this before in their lives. With that being said, here you go, guys. Here is episode 4 of the Jeanette Robertson series from the Underestimated podcast. And after you listen to episode 4, later today, episode 5 is going to drop. Then you need to go to the Underestimated feed, download it, and listen to all the episodes about all the cases and hear from all the students. Here's episode 4 of Jeanette Robertson's case.
They think we're lazy.
They think we're weak-willed.
They think we're entitled.
They think we're selfish.
They think we don't care about anybody but ourselves.
We are compassionate.
We are resourceful.
We are capable.
We want to make a difference in the world.
We are underestimated.
Hello, and welcome back to Underestimated. In this episode, we will be backtracking a bit. In the previous episode, we revealed that we believe that Jeanette's killer is a woman. In this episode, we want to further explain how we got to this theory. We first learn how to make a victimology profile from Jim Clementi, a former FBI profiler, at the beginning of the school year. Our entire class met with him over a Zoom call so that we could learn how to make a profile for each one of our cases. Then we eventually made a profile for Jeanette.
So as a profiler, the crime tells a story, and we want to be able to read that story. We look for behavioral clues that indicate the kind of person who committed that crime. And understand that behavior reflects personality. When we're conducting a criminal investigative analysis, when we're using behavioral analysis, we look at how a crime was committed. How did this offender get access to this victim? What did they do with the victim? What they did indicates why they did it. And when you add the how and the why, that leads to the who committed the crime. So we reverse engineer crimes. We look at behavior exhibited at a crime scene, and we work backwards to try to figure out who committed that crime. It's not like what people call racial profiling, for example, and saying that we think this kind of person is going to commit this crime. We never do forward like that. What we do is reverse engineer. When a crime has been committed, we point backwards to the type of person who committed that crime. And that is all based on how they behaved before, during, and after the crime. So we also look at the organization level of the offender. So did this offender plan out these crimes? Did he bring all the implements necessary to commit the crimes? And did he take them with him from the scene? Was he forensically and criminally sophisticated? Or was this something that was done at the last minute? They gathered all the things that they used to commit the crime right from the crime scene, and they left all the sorts of stuff and forensic evidence behind. That tells me it's somebody who's impulsive, somebody who's not planning, somebody who doesn't have maybe the mental capacity, or their inhibitions are lowered by substance abuse or high levels of stress. So victimology is the study of the victim. Everything you could possibly know about the victim. This is incredibly important. It is the foundation of how we build the profile. And in some cases, it is all the information that we have when we build a profile. Risk levels, we look at the risk level of the offender and of the victim. Risk level for the offender is he committing this crime in the middle of a farm in Iowa where there's no witnesses other than cows and chickens? Or is he committing in the middle of Times Square where there's 100,000 people at any time of the day or night? For the victim risk assessment, victims who are in the privacy of their own home and security of their own home are very low-risk victims. They're engaged in activities that are very safe, whereas people who are out on the road, whether they're hitchhiking or sex workers or some other or drug addicts that are outside and exposed to the criminal element, they're living a higher-risk lifestyle. An offender who takes advantage of victims who are high-risk doesn't have to expend as much energy, doesn't have to have as much skill. But an offender who's taking a high risk by going into a secured home in a nice neighborhood and taking advantage of a very low risk victim, that offender has to have a much higher skill level. So you see how what he did and his victim choice and the location of his crimes reflect back on who he or she is. The control that somebody exhibits at a crime scene is going to be important because that will reflect back on the type of control that person most likely exhibits in his real life. Staging is when you try to make a crime scene look like an accident, like a different type of crime, or a suicide, or a natural death. The persons who commit staging, who actually engage in staging, which takes time, means they're elevating their risk. They're spending more time there. Typically, that's because they have a known connection to the crime scene or the victim. So they take the time to change what it looks like in hopes that they'll get away from with the crime. Body disposal is another thing that's really important because a body could be, you could shoot somebody in the middle of a road and leave the body there. That's discarding the body. Or you could put the body in a trunk and drive somewhere else and dump the body right out in the open where it's going to be discovered. Or you could take time to conceal it. And the more time you take to conceal it, the more likely that there is a known connection between the offender and the victim. Undoing is another aspect that you'll hear about. Undoing is when somebody may feel remorse, may feel disgust at what they've done. So they symbolically try to undo it. Could be by throwing some papers on top of the face of the victim. It could be by throwing a blanket on top of the victim. It could be by redressing the victim and making them, you know, look like they're just sleeping in bed. It could be any of those aspects. So when we're doing criminal investigative analysis, there's five things that we look at. Victimology, the crime scene. Victimology, the crime location, the crime scene, offender organization level, and offender behavior. So let's break them down. Victimology, as I already told you, it's looking at every single thing that you can possibly find out about the victim. Nothing is unimportant. Social media, their hobbies, their likes, the movies they wanted to see, their sports that they're interested in. Everything is important because it can have an interaction with the offender. It could create the reason why the offender picked them. But looking at victimology is like holding up a mirror to the offender, because every offender picks a particular victim at a particular time, at a particular place, in a particular manner, for a particular purpose. And all those choices reflect back on the offender, what they are capable of, what they are desiring to do. So the access to the victims, but also how they interacted. How much time did the offender spend with the victim? What did he do? Was he sadistic? What is he telling us about what his needs and desires are based on what he did with the victim? Okay. And then we look at the offender behavior and we really evaluate the MO and ritual aspects. We see if there's a signature that can help us tie it to other crimes. But basically, the entire evaluation is built one brick on top of the other. You have to go in this order: victimology, crime location, crime scene, organization level, and offender behavior.
You may remember that in our second episode, we briefly touched on Jeanette's victimology profile. But to gain a deeper understanding of her murder, we are examining the crime scene behaviors more closely in this episode. Before writing the script of this episode, our teacher helped our group come up with some crime scene behaviors to add to our already existing profile of Jeanette. We listed everything we came up with on the whiteboard and then elaborated to come up with the information we are about to share with you. We wanted to make an accurate and detailed profile to send to Jim Clementi to see if we made an accurate profile like how he taught us. We wanted to hear his opinions after reading our profile and if he believes we are correct about our suspects.
The information that follows is the actual profile that we sent to Jim Clementi for him to analyze for us, so some of the information may be a bit repetitive. You have most likely heard some of this in our previous episodes, but we had to make sure to include everything we know about the murder in her profile.
Jeanette Robertson was a 27-year-old woman who was very pretty and petite. She was 5 feet tall and around 125 pounds. She was married to Alvin Robertson and had 2 young children. She had no obvious high risk factors. There was no history of drug or alcohol abuse, no sex work, or anything similar. The only risk factor we were able to think of is a potential love triangle. Jeanette and her husband Alvin had previously lived in Georgia, and according to rumor, Jeanette had an affair with one of her husband's friends when they lived down there. They had been living in Reed City for 8 months prior to her death.
According to the original investigators, it was believed that her husband was having an affair with their 19-year-old babysitter at the time of Jeanette's murder. We haven't found any confirmation of that. However, he did move away with her shortly after the murder, and they eventually married. There are also rumors, according to the police chief of the time, that Jeanette may have also been having an affair at the time. These are only identified risk factors. Other than the fact that she worked alone in the basement of the Gamble store. Moving on to the details of her actual murder.
It was a normal weekday afternoon. Customers shuffled in and out of the store all day. Around 1 p.m., Jeanette's husband stopped by the store to bring her lunch. This wasn't a normal occurrence as he was usually at work, but he had recently been laid off, so he was home that day. He was witnessed coming into the store with lunch, and according to him, it was a normal and short visit, and he left. Between 1:30 and 4 p.m., a few customers came in and went down to the pet store, but Jeanette was nowhere to be found. A couple of them asked the upstairs employees where she was, and they said she was probably at lunch. No one thought much of it. Finally, at around 4 p.m., a customer who had waited around for a while asked the owner when she would be back. When he realized she had been MIA for a couple hours at that point, he sent an employee down to look for her, along with the customer.
The pet department was long and narrow. Immediately at the bottom of the stairs was the checkout counter. Jeanette's half-eaten lunch was on the counter, a tuna fish sandwich with bites out of it. The room is about 60 feet long. Along with one of the long walls were fish tanks. At the end of the room, opposite of the stairs, were birdcages built into the wall. There was a door in the back corner between the fish tanks and the birdcages that led to the storage and boiler area and allowed access behind the fish tanks. Then there was another door in the back area that led into the room behind the birdcages. When the employee opened the door to get to the storage/boiler area, there was a pool of blood on the floor. They then opened the closed door to the birdcage room and found Jeanette's body on the floor, tucked under birdcages so you couldn't see it by looking through them. You actually had to go into the room to see her. She was found with her shirt and bra pulled up, exposing her breasts, and her pants and underwear pulled down to her ankles.
Today's episode is sponsored by First Form. And listen up. I did it. I passed it. And I'm moving forward to a new goal. As of this morning, I weighed in at 233.1 pounds, which is 3 pounds more than my 100-pound weight loss goal. That's right. I've now lost 103 pounds using First Form's app and their supplements over the course of 2.5 years. And that, my friends, is what real results look like. That's not a fad diet. That's not some yo-yo plan. It's not some new hot trend that you're going to do for a few weeks, lose some pounds, and put it right back on. That is consistent, sustainable weight loss. And throughout that time, I built a ton of muscle. I feel better now than I did in my 20s. In fact, the last time I weighed this much, I was in my 20s. And I'm now, of course, 46 years old. First Form is a real solution that really works. They have a system and an app that will help guide you on your journey and tons of great supplements to help you out along the way. Real quick today, I want to tell you about one of my favorites, something I never skip. I have it every single morning, and that's First Form's OptiGreens 50. First Form's OptiGreens are the only greens that I've ever had that don't taste terrible. Now, don't get me wrong, they're still greens. But their natural berry flavor definitely tastes better than probably any other greens you've ever had. And for me, I've gotten to kind of be addicted to it. I look forward to the taste every single morning. And there's tons of benefits with OptiGreens 50. It helps support a healthy immune system, your gut health, digestion, gives you natural energy, and pH balance. It doesn't matter whether it's January or June, staying healthy is important all year long. You know how it is. As soon as somebody coughs around us, it's time to quick disinfect every surface and break out the hand sanitizer. But there's a lot more that you can do to protect yourself and your health. And OptiGreens is one of those things that'll help get you there. It's your quick and convenient way to get your daily dose of nutrient-rich greens without the sourcing, preparing, cooking, and cleaning. It's the perfect solution for busy lifestyles. Because as you guys know, I've got a pretty busy life. I have two full-time jobs. I got three kids at home, my wife, I'm taking full-time college classes. So I don't always have time to steam some vegetables with dinner, but I know that I'm always getting my greens because I always have my dose of First Form OptiGreens 50. And it's gluten-free, non-GMO, and there's no artificial flavors. And look, the OptiGreens, that's just one of the great supplements that I use and recommend for First Form. And again, I want to remind you, this isn't just some sponsor, just some ad that I'm reading. This is a system and a series of products that I have actually used starting at age 42 to lose over 100 pounds. I can personally speak for the results. And now's the time for you to get serious about your nutrition and your health. And you can get started today at firstform.com/truth. When you go there, they'll give you free shipping on any order over $75. And if you're a new customer, they're going to email you a link and let you try out their app for free. And listen, they have a 110% money-back guarantee on their product. So if you don't like it, you can get your money back. And then some. But I promise you, that's not going to happen. Every single one of their products that I've used and use regularly, from the greens to the multi-factor vitamins, to the protein shakes, to the protein bars, the meat sticks, the energy drinks, everything. I love it all. It's all very effective and it all tastes great. And you can get it all at firstform.com/truth. That's the number one, firstform.com/truth.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
After examining the crime scene and the body, it was discovered that Jeanette had been hit on the head with some kind of large blunt object. The police and medical examiner determined it was likely a painted rock that might be put into an aquarium. The injury fractured and indented her skull, causing brain injuries that were ultimately determined to be her cause of death, but she didn't die right away. Her body was mutilated while she was almost certainly unconscious, but still alive. She was stabbed repeatedly by what the medical examiner described as something like a barbecue fork. She was stabbed in the temple, the neck, and the chest with it. Based on our research, we believe it was more than likely a forked tool used to clean fish aquariums back in the 80s. She was also strangled, but not to death. Her hyoid was fractured, and there was bruising on her neck and petechia in her eyes.
She was also sliced up with what's believed to be a box cutter on her face, breast, and chest. The medical examiner concluded that Jeanette's chest had been stomped on. She had bruising on her chest and fractures of her sternum and ribs on both sides adjacent to the sternum. She was sexually assaulted by some kind of rod or broom handle. It was forced into her mouth, causing severe injuries, and was also inserted into her rectum so hard that it ruptured the lining of the vaginal wall. Her body was left nude and bloodied and shoved under the bird cages. The killer would have had a clear view of the store and anyone who came in from the birdcage room, which is where the police determined the mutilation took place. They could see out and the people could see in, although they could easily duck down and get out of sight.
The door to the birdcage room was closed. That door is just 12 inches or so away from the main door from the pet store into the back room. There was no blood or signs of a struggle in the main part of the store. The back of the door between the storage/boiler area and store had blood splattered on it. There was also blood pooled on the floor right there and splattered on the shelves next to the door. As mentioned earlier, her lunch was still half eaten back at the cash register.
We believe that Jeanette willingly stepped into the back room with her attacker, perhaps to have a private conversation. She interrupted her lunch to go back into an area where customers typically weren't allowed with someone. We believe that she was unconscious at that point. Her body was then drugged approximately 6 feet into the birdcage room. The killer then spent a considerable amount of time with her body desecrating it. Based on the witness statements from customers who were in and out, we believe that the killer was back in that room with Jeanette and was able to see customers coming in and out looking for her. The most perplexing part is how the killer exited the building undetected. The crime scene techs didn't identify any of the weapons at the scene, which would indicate the killer took them with them. It's also likely the killer had blood on them and yet no one saw them leave.
There are only two routes that can be taken to exit the basement, either through the wall into the hobby shop and up those stairs, which is the least likely. That route would take them up into the middle of the menswear department, and the back door on that side of the building was locked. So they would then have to walk through the store to the front door and past the main checkout counter, or up the stairs from the pet department. That route would land them upstairs in the hardware store sections. We believe that door had panic hardware and would have been a viable way out. Going out the back door would lead to the large parking lot, as opposed to exiting onto the main street that would have been full of people going from shop to shop. No one reported seeing anyone with blood on them or carrying any of the items that were used as weapons, which again would include some type of fork device, a rock or something similar, a box cutter or knife, and a rod, pipe, or handle.
There are a few notable behaviors that I think are important to mention. Jeanette left her half-eaten lunch to go into the back room with her attacker. This indicates that the unsub or unidentified subject is someone that she knew or was familiar with. It also indicates that this person was not perceived to be a physical threat by Jeanette. The fact that she went into a private area with the door closed indicates that the purpose for this interaction was likely personal or private. Another behavior is that nothing was stolen. There was still money left in the cash register. Jeanette had her jewelry on, and her purse was at the counter and was undisturbed. Therefore, robbery was not a motive. Body concealment is another behavior. Body concealment was temporary. The purpose of the concealment appears to be an attempt to buy the unsub some time to escape. This indicates that obviously the killer knew that they couldn't be caught with the body, but they felt they could get away with it if they could put some distance between them and the crime scene before the body was found. This indicates that the unsub did not have a known personal relationship to the victim, at least not to the extent that they would be an immediate suspect upon the body being discovered. Another behavior is the immediacy of the initial attack. Based on no one hearing Ray's voices or screaming, and the fact that the blow to the head would cause immediate incapacitation and unconsciousness, we believe that the unsub came to the store with violence in mind. It should be noted that we visited the crime scene and learned that you could pretty easily hear someone speaking loudly in the basement from upstairs. A scream would definitely be heard. But no one heard any screaming or had any indication of anything that was happening the day of the murder. There's no indication that there was any kind of struggle or escalation that led to the attack. Based on the evidence we have, we believe that the unsub lured Jeanette into the back room. As Jeanette turned to close the door behind her, the unsub grabbed the first heavy object they saw and bashed her over the head. The skull fractures were on the forehead and right temporal area of the skull. This could indicate that either Jeanette was facing her attacker when she was struck, or she was in the process of turning around from closing the door. It's impossible to indicate right or left-handed due to the unknown factors and the dynamic nature of such an attack.
The The nature of this initial attack indicates that the unsub was motivated by anger. While there was not a known personal connection, the unsub did have a connection to Jeanette. They knew her and they hated her. We've speculated that it's likely the unsub and Jeanette shared a person in common. This was a personal cause homicide, but the crime scene behaviors indicate a lack of known personal relationship. We believe that it would take something personal and relational to trigger this type of rage. Therefore, we believe there is an overlap between someone in Jeanette's inner circle of relationships and that unsub's inner circle.
We personally believe the attacker was smaller in size or weaker. Here are a few indicators of that. We found that the unsub's choice to grab a heavy, blunt object for the initial attack speaks to their lack of physical strength. Jeanette was 5 feet tall and weighing around 125 pounds. She was also so small in stature that it seemed odd that her attacker would feel the need to use such a weapon to neutralize her. We believe that a grown man would attack with his hands and not feel the need to use a weapon. When we couple that with the attempted manual strangulation that ultimately was unsuccessful, and the fact that the stomping of the chest only resulted in small fractures of the sternum and ribs, we've concluded that this indicates either a female unsub or at the very least, a exceptionally small or weak male.
The mutilation of the body is once again an indicator. It indicates rage aimed directly at Jeanette. She was also left in a state of undress with no indications of remorse or compassion after the fact, almost as if the unsub intended to further humiliate Jeanette even after death. The focus on Jeanette's sexual areas is a huge behavior that we need to focus on. We find it notable that the unsub took the time to undress Jeanette and mutilated her breast, vagina, rectum, and mouth. None of these injuries were fatal. They weren't intended to kill her. We believe that the source of the unsub's anger towards Jeanette stems from something sexual. This could indicate impotence in the offender or some sort of sexual embarrassment. However, when coupled with the other factors that indicate a female offender and someone who has overlap in close relationships with Jeanette, we believe these behaviors indicate that the overlap likely stems from sexual relationships, meaning that the unsub and Jeanette have a sexual partner in common.
Another crime scene behavior is the lack of preparation. The unsub came into the store with violence in mind, but did not come with a plan. According to the initial investigation, all weapons used could be items found at the store. This indicates that we are dealing with a disorganized offender. The unsub was reckless and impulsive. This indicates someone younger, likely late teens or early 20s, before the frontal cortex is fully developed. The location is a big factor as well. Jeanette was targeted in an open and operating store in the middle of the day. In general, this is about the worst possible location to choose to carry out an act like this. The location tells us a few things. One, the unsub knew Jeanette's schedule. They knew she would be at work. Two, they were familiar enough with the store to know that they could isolate Jeanette in the basement. And three, the unsub did not have a close enough relationship with Jeanette that they had any other options to get Jeanette alone. They would not feel welcome in her home, and they had no way of predicting where she could be at any given time. The only reason to carry out the act at the store was because it was the only viable option. This choice also speaks to the immaturity and impulsiveness of the unsub. They didn't have the patience to stalk Jeanette or find another place or time.
Based on all of these behaviors, we personally believe that the unsub that we're looking for is a young female. She's between 17 and 24 years old. School was in session at the time of the murder, therefore it's unlikely, but not impossible, that the unsub was still in high school. She also wasn't working at the time of the murder. She either didn't work, worked a different shift, or was off that day. She and Jeanette shared a sexual partner. She is most likely a white woman. In Reed City in 1983, a person of color in the store would have been noteworthy to the customers and the staff. There are no reports from any witnesses of any non-white customers coming in or out that day. She has anger/violence issues. This type of violence is rarely an isolated incident. People in the unsub's life would know her to fly off the handle when she's angry.
We believe that a lack of proper behavioral analysis in 1983 is what caused this case to remain unsolved for 40 years. Based on the case file, it's clear that the initial investigators were looking for a man. It seems to never even occur to them that a woman could be responsible, and therefore they didn't pursue any avenue of investigation that might have led them to a female suspect. But we believe we could find more answers if we look in the direction of female suspects that nobody else has looked before. By reconsidering the behavioral patterns and shifting the focus towards a female perpetrator, a possibility that was overlooked at the time, we open the door to new leads, new interviews, and ultimately new truth. It's time to correct the assumptions of the past and pursue the suspect who may have been hiding in plain sight all along.
Underestimated. Jeanette Robertson was researched, written, and produced by Chelsea, Stephanie, Aubrey, Riley, Logan, and Carter. Intro music done by Haley. All other music done by Shane Yoder. Our show artwork was created by Chelsea, and our series artwork was also created by Chelsea. The Underestimated podcast is a production created in the Brandywine Community Schools Broadcasting CTE program. We want to thank you for listening, and a huge thank you to our community sponsors for supporting us and helping fund our work. Please make sure you leave us a review on your favorite podcast player. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Underestimated.